Hello, everyone, and welcome to Korean Context. I'm your host, Jenna Gibson. This week, we have a special episode. We recorded it a few weeks ago when KEI was down in Atlanta, Georgia for the International Studies Association Conference. Our guest for this episode was Alexander Gaguev, who joined us from Moscow for the conference. So please take a listen and enjoy this special episode. Hello, and welcome to Korean Context. I'm your host, Jenna Gibson. We have a special episode today. This week, KEI is down in Atlanta, Georgia for the International Studies Association Conference. At the conference, we sponsored two panel discussions, one on China's security intentions in Asia and one on South Korea-Japan relations. One of the great experts who presented in that first panel is today's guest, Alexander Gaguev. Gaguev is a senior associate and the chair of the Russia in the Asia-Pacific program at Carnegie Moscow Center. Before joining Carnegie, he was a journalist and editor in Russia, covering various issues, including diplomatic and foreign relations. So we're very excited to talk to him today about his paper and about Russia's view on Asia in general. So to start off, the article you wrote for our panel here at ISA is entitled "Deciphering China's Security Intentions in Northeast Asia, A View from Russia." In it, you describe what you call a two-faced approach, which I thought was really interesting. So there's some cooperation in some sectors and contention in others. Can you describe for our listeners this two-faced approach and what it means for China and Russia going forward?
Great to be with you, and thank you for inviting me. I think that Russia's policy towards China and Russia's analysis of China's action and strategy is based on several assumptions and underlying factors. We can describe them more properly, but just very basic. They are, first, the state of the expertise in Russia, which is in sort of devastation after the fall of the Soviet Union. And number two is Russia's elite obsession with the West, its desire to be integrated with the West. And number three is concern about long-term Chinese intentions with the Russian Far East, the Russian elite and decision-maker look at just very basic facts. 6 million people in the Russian Far East, 110 million across the border, economic dynamism on the Chinese side of the border, loss of vitality or degradation on the Russian part of the border, sort of migration in the 90s, and they are very much aware of difficult historical issues, and that creates a lot of anxiety. So the approach all the time was, yes, we need China for developing the economy. We feel that there is a lot of complementarity in the economic structure, and we definitely need to reach out to China if Russia is to develop its Far East and Siberian region. And on the other hand, the second phase of this approach was always, oh, China is so dangerous. We should build this partnership, but let's not go too deep into that because they are scary. We don't know what they think. We don't know what they're up to. So there were a lot of reservations on the Russian side at the same time.
How do you see this juxtaposition working in the future? Because if you have both of these things going on at once, it's really hard to work towards cooperation or towards a larger goal together.
Exactly. And I think that there are two things. One, there are remaining contradictions, particularly internally. And you would always have that this partnership has underlying perfect base, right? There is an economic base. Russia has abundance of natural resources. Russia requires a lot of infrastructure, a lot of capital, a lot of technical know-how, and China has that. On the same time, China definitely needs a lot of resources Russia can provide, and that's not only oil, gas, or metals, but also water, arable land, climate, like natural cold, for example, to store data, and fundamental research Russia has in several areas. Like a lot of Russian mathematicians went to China to train the generations of Chinese mathematicians, and Russian military technology is superior in some parts of the spectrum, so the Chinese still rely on that. And the second pillar was always the nature of the polities, right? Both countries are not liberal democracies. One is a democracy with Chinese characteristics. The other is Russian sovereign democracy. What brings them together is that they are not Western-type democracies. So a lot of common views on human rights, responsibility to protect, sovereignty, cyberspace, which really creates a common agenda. But there will be always these reservations and fears. So I think that Russia and China are bound to become partners, but not allies, because there is not enough trust, not enough understanding, and not enough desire to care for each other's mutual interests. On the flip side, after the Ukrainian crisis, I think as Russia really started to reach out to Asia Pacific and to look for alternative, because it got under international sanctions after MH17 crash in Eastern Ukraine and its meddling in Donbass war. So a lot of these issues became much more acute for Russia just to find alternative sources of capital, alternative markets, try to reach out to different countries in Asia. But ASEAN is a small market for Russia, too far away. Japan and Korea are U.S. allies, so are sometimes subject to U.S. political pressure and also are very cautious themselves. So there was only one natural place to go, that's China. And that's where a lot of these internal barriers or taboos started to be put under review or gradually removed. I think Russia has moved a long way towards China. And the reason why we are not seeing a boom in mutual investment and trade is that this rapprochement is happening under very harsh external conditions. Number one is the current situation on the commodity market. Number two, a variety of markets, like all the markets are pretty depressed. Number two is internal dynamism of the Chinese economy, the slowdown, the anti-corruption campaign. And number three are the international sanctions, which also work in China. So if you're a big Chinese state-owned bank and you choose between a small, depressed, shrinking, overregulated Russian market, and you're looking at the American market or European markets where you are to expand, where you have additional businesses with instruments like AIB or One Belt One Road, or you are part of the RMB promotion, then your choice is obvious. You stay away from Russia, you do business with the West. And that's what was happening. So I think these were the natural limits which limit the economic cooperation nowadays.
So this is interesting because you mentioned the Ukraine crisis, and this is something that came up in the panel discussion yesterday. Someone had asked the question if the Ukraine crisis had triggered some sort of change in the Russia-China relationship. And I thought you had a really interesting answer, which was the underlying, I guess, conditions were already there, but this was a sort of trigger. So can you elaborate a little bit on that for our listeners?
I think that these underlying economic factors and political factors will always there. And besides, China and Russia are neighbors. They share over 4,000 kilometers of border and just a lot of natural synergy to work together. On the other hand, you have this, you know, psychological factors and different issues. And for China also, Russia was never too much of a priority. That was a convenient partner to work with, but they felt Russians would never have enough trust. Russians were slow, Russians were arrogant to build the pipelines. And yes, Russia is a perfect place to go for the first state visit when you are elected as president or secretary general, right? But that's not perhaps your most important partner, because your most important partner will be U.S. for the foreseeable future. And on the flip side, I think that Ukraine really pushed Russia a lot into this direction. So Russians had to work more closely on China. Another factor was, and I think China was also opportunistic in exploring this opportunity. They see, okay, we can get a lot of assets, which Russia was reluctant to sell to the Chinese investors or to allow Chinese participation in some projects. Now we can do that. And the second sentiment was, okay, Russia, in Kissingerian sense, there is this Russia, US, China, big powers triangle. And the US strategy was always to have better relationship with both Russia and China than they have their state of mutual relationship. So now China was exactly in the position that it had a robust, comprehensive relationship with the US, not with some downsides, but more or less stable and manageable. It had this partnership with Russia, and it wanted to build on this partnership. Like Russia, which is driven apart from the West, is something China is very much interested in because that's sort of strategic backyard, right? Strategic support, something which will never allow the encirclement of China, of which China is so much afraid to happen. Number three factor were also the relationship between Putin and Xi Jinping, because this is the first generation of Russian and Chinese leaders who are of the same age. Hu Jintao was 10 years older than Putin, and Jiang Zemin was 20 years older. And here they have some sort of the same generation people, tough leaders, large challenges, non-Western or sometimes anti-Western outlook on issues, fighting the oligarchs on one side, fighting corruption on the other side. So both men have a lot in common and they sort of learn from each other.
I want to shift a bit from Russia-China to Russia-North Korea. We've been talking a lot lately at KEI about the new round of sanctions on North Korea following the recent provocations. In this case, the US and China had drafted the sanctions, and then Russia asked for some time to review them, made a few changes, and eventually went along with the resolution. So can you tell me a little bit your view on Russia's role in this round of sanctions? In many cases, we think of China and Russia being the ones that team up against, you know, the US, Britain, France, on the Security Council, but in this case, China and the U.S. teamed up, and then Russia came in afterwards. So what was Russia's role there?
The basic fact is that despite Russia being a neighbor of North Korea, and despite Russia being historically a very significant ally and role model, the current state of relationship is not that great, right? North Korea is not important. Russia is not that very much concerned about the nuclear program. It's concerned about the imperfections of North Korean nuclear technology. If something terrible happens, like an accident, that's of a concern. Big regional war is also of a concern. But I don't think that the Russians are really too concerned about the North Korea or the state of the regime, the nature of the regime. And second point is that the leverages, the layers of influence Russia has over North Korea are really exaggerated. Russia doesn't have that much of trade, that much of political influence there, and that much support. So I think that it went along with six-party talk. It was very important for Russia as a great power to be there, and it was more considerations of prestige. Like you are part of an elite club, you sit at the table to be there, but not enough constructive involvement, not enough constructive approach. And Russia was always following China's lead and doing what the Chinese doing. Here, I think with the recent provocations on the North Korean side, the Chinese have an acute feeling that their policy failed, right? Didn't have enough layers of influence over the younger Kim, and they need to do something different. And then the US had a plan, they co-developed a plan, and they teamed up, excluding Russia as sort of irrelevant player. And Russia was not consulted, and it wasn't opposed to sanctions per se, right? But it just didn't want to disappear entirely. It wanted to make its presence at the table visible. That's why I said, wait a minute, I was not consulted. I need some time to review. I will make my valuable comments. But Russia definitely didn't have anything really to add. So there were minor changes. And then Russia just sided with everyone else. But it was also partly to give North Korea face, right? To say that we are the only sort of partner or friend or anyone who is more of somebody who cares and who tries to understand the situation more than this, you know, big guys who want to go for sanctions.
Over the years, Russia has tried to propose some various engagements with North Korea, including, you know, a rail line and things like that. Do you think that this new round of sanctions, which is really tough, has kind of closed the door on that for now?
I think so, but I also think that a lot of these projects have really not picked up. The rail was there, but Rajin station and port. But whether that would be a big, significant driver for the economy, for development of the Far East, only time would tell. And I think a lot of these projects, from the Russian point of view, from the point of view of government critics, seem to be just wasting precious resources and money, sort of corrupt initiatives driven primarily by desire of some official of the Russian railway monopolies or Gazprom to enrich themselves. So it's good to have this project trilateral trying to link North Korea and South Korea, give North Koreans some economic incentive to be a stable, predictable player. Sounds very good in theory. It never worked in the practice. So I think that these projects are really shelved for a long time.
So I definitely want to ask you this, especially given that you worked in the media in Russia for some time before joining Carnegie. What is the public opinion of North Korea, and what is the public opinion of China, given that the that Russia is now cooperating a little bit more there?
I think there is basically not much public opinion on North Korea, even in the polls that comes as sort of dangerous player. But Russian society is very ignorant and illiterate. North Korea is somewhere far, far away. Russia doesn't consider it as a big threat. I think people, Far East is a little bit different because North Korea is just across the border. But most of what people know from North Korea are the refugees or migrants, some business ties, you know, but just very small in scale. As for China, the change is really significant. Number of people who view China positively has reached all-time high last year of 81%. I think that's increased by about 20% over the last 2 years. That's significant. And the number of people who view China negative have fallen to all-time low, below 10%. That's really significant. So I think that all these, you know, fears are just going away, even in central Russia, because it's interesting that there is a big difference. In the Far East, which actually borders China, people are not that much afraid. They are not negative. They are saying, hey, China brings development. Chinese don't want to live here because there are just a tiny industries like agriculture and stuff where you see visible Chinese demographic presence. Others are just temporary workers. So people say, hey, we want actually more of Chinese money, more of Chinese tourism, more of Chinese investment here. And they were not afraid. Afraid was Moscow, which sees like, oh, this is this big yellow giant looming large over Siberia. And where do they go with all their population? They definitely want to go to Russia, you know, drink all the oil and take all the women and all, you know, the wood, timber, water, whatever they can get hold of. So I think that is changing, and the more realistic picture is starting to be aired in the media.
So those are the questions that I had for you. But I do want to give you a chance if you have anything else that you want to say about Russia's turn to the East and its view towards China here and North Korea. Is there anything else that you think our listeners should know about?
I think that Russia's pivot to Asia may seem, as for now, very not successful, not strategic, very emotional, short-termist, which in many aspects it is. But I think that it is because the underlying assumption is that sanctions and bad relationship with the West is there to stay for a considerable time. I don't think there will be business as usual anytime soon. I wish I would be proven wrong, but that's my impression. So Russia will be forced to do more in Asia, and it will do that in a sometimes stupid, awkward, very Russian way, but it will become a more visible player. And I think it will be more of a junior partner to China, but that's the normal status Russia can and needs to accept now. I think Chinese will be very smart in in playing that because they are like in the U.S. to see the president as president of Botswana. You never see the president of the U.S., right? Your level is just very technical level in the State Department. It needs to be something extraordinary to happen that you see, because this is sort of a reward to see the president, leader of the free world. Whereas China is very much, at least symbolically, or on the surface, formally, they are very much supporting this equality of the states. So Chinese would see leaders of very small, not important nations just giving them face. And I think this is the big difference between West's approach to Russia and China's approach to Russia, that the West, well-intentioned, but always started to teach Russia how to, you know, structure its polity, how to make the economy functioning, what Russia should do about its human rights, and this and that, whether China say, oh, we don't interfere in your internal affairs, you're a great power, we have respect. Under the carpet, the deals may be very harsh, and the nature of conversation will be maybe much harsher than the pragmatic conversation Russia has with Americans and Europeans. But on the surface, it's very respectful. And I think that because Russia is very emotionally attached to its status as great power and just wants to be given face, I think that China's approach will work.
Okay, great. We are here in Atlanta, and I want to say thank you for joining us today, Alex.
Thank you for having me.
That's all for this episode of Korean Context. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and we'll see you here again next week.